Today is Thursday, April 12th, 2018. It's 2 p.m., and this is panel number 4307 entitled Getting Real and Getting Ahead in Politics, Work, and Life. We have a spectacular panel of speakers today. I'm Lori Bergen, and I'm the Dean of the College of Media, Communication, and Information here at CU Boulder. And I want to share first brief bios of each of our panelists, and then each of them will take 5 minutes to prepare or provide an opening statement. Then we'll do a little back and forth amongst the panelists, and then there will be opportunities for everyone to ask questions at the end of the session. First, I'd like to introduce Heather Hurlburt. She directs the New Models of Policy Change Initiative at the New Americas Political Reform Program. She's a foreign policy columnist for New York Magazine and co-hosts the Dresbert podcast with Tufts Fletcher School professor Dan Dresner. She served in the White House and State Department under President Bill Clinton, worked on Capitol Hill, and was a member of the U.S. delegation to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So please join me in welcoming Heather Hurlburt. Next to Heather, from her home on the coast of Italy's beautiful Lake Garda, Lisa Marie Simmons collaboratively leads two different ensembles, Hippie Tendencies and Notespeak, with keyboardist, arranger, and songwriter Marco Cremaschini, each deeply but differently informed by the struggles and triumphs in Lisa's own life. Lisa began singing at a very young age and was featured soloist with the Boulder Youth Choir. She attended Fairview High School, and at age 19, she moved to New York City to study theater and music at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. She performs in pop, funk, soul, blues, and jazz bands throughout the Manhattan club circuit at night. Please join me in welcoming Lisa Marie back to Boulder. Next to Lisa is Erin Velarde. She's the founder and director of Vote, Run, Lead, a national nonpartisan organization that unleashes the power of women leaders in democracy through training, technology, and community. She first launched VRL as vice president of program and communications at the White House Project, establishing the largest national political training program readying women for public office and civic life, training over 15,000 women. Erin serves on the advisory boards of Girl Meets World, the New American Leaders Project, and Democracy.com. And she's on the leadership teams of Vision 2020 and Political Parity. Please join me in welcoming Erin to Boulder. Last, I'd like to introduce Sue Heilbronner. She's co-founder and CEO of MergeLane, a leading accelerator for startups with at least one female in leadership. She offers companies and audiences deep insights into how to create a culture that fully empowers and leverages high-potential females in leadership. She began her career as an attorney, last as a federal prosecutor with the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. She transitioned to business by founding an online baby gift company in 1999. She's been an adjunct professor in our law school at CU Boulder, and she lives in Boulder. So please join me in welcoming Sue. Heather, I'd like to let you take the opportunity to do our first opening statement, and please forge ahead.
Thanks. We are going to try to really do this lightning round style and get to dialogue with each other and you all as quickly as possible. So since I get to go first, when I saw the title, the sort of getting real aspect of the title, I thought, ooh, there are some things I'm pretty mad about that I want to let off some steam about in this context. But I think I'll actually start with something, a really positive comment that occurs to me sort of in hearing about the bios of the folks on the panel with me, some of whom I've known for a while and some of whom I've met for the first time today. And that is that, I mean, everybody up here really forged her own path in a very non-traditional way, and I think none of us had a career path that you, or a life path that you could read about in a book, or that, you know, when I was 16 years old, I could have said, oh, I want to do this the way she did this. So the sort of get real number one is that you do have to figure it out for yourself, that nobody can tell you how to do you. That there is no mentor who's career you can perfectly copy or whose life you can perfectly pattern yourself on to get yourself to a place that feels satisfying and authentic and good. So sort of get real number one is you got to figure it out for yourself. And the sort of get real number two that goes along with that is that that is a lifelong process that you do not, I personally keep waiting to get to the place where I have it all figured, where someone else tells me that I have it all figured out. I'm kind of guilty of that one. Something that I have really had to get real with myself about in the last year, frankly, working as I do at the intersection of politics and national security, is that my field's very hierarchical. And I've always been in the position of, oh, there's someone else I can check with. There's someone else who knows how they did it on the John Kerry campaign or in the Jimmy Carter administration, or even how did we do that back in the Clinton administration, or how did we do that the last time we were trying to pass an arms control treaty? And man, I keep looking around, where are the adults who can help me figure out how to navigate this period? And guess what? I am the adult. And lots of us, but I think, frankly, especially women, don't always grab hold of our inner adult quite as soon as we should. And that is something I am still working on very hard myself. So feel free to grab hold of your inner adult early and often. Point three, and this is where I'm just going to do a little venting. I turned 50 this year. And I have, you know, I'm the daughter of a mom who wanted to be a diplomat and couldn't be a diplomat because women were not allowed to be married if they were in the Foreign Service, and she also knew she wanted to marry my dad. She was a journalist and was repeatedly denied opportunities to work in her field because she was female. And so she gave me both an enormous track record of persistence, which is super important. As I say to my son all the time, this stubbornness of yours is going to serve you very well as an adult, provided we all survive your childhood. Don't get scared, Aaron. And the other thing my mom left me, though, was, and then she did this with the best of intentions, the idea that my world was going to be so much better than her world was. And that, man, I was a girl growing up in the 70s and 80s, and I could do anything, and I could go anywhere, and that had been firmly established, end of story. And so it came as a very rude shock to me in college and after college to discover that that wasn't quite true. The first time one of my dear friends in college said to me, well, yeah, you know, it's no surprise that you don't like that political science class. Women don't usually like arms control. Mm. So guess what my first job after college was? Like I said, stubborn. But what I find even more distressing is the things that I encountered as a young woman that I thought would be different now that aren't. I participated in a project over the last couple of years interviewing senior national security figures to try to understand, as we took an incredible step forward in my field in the Obama administration in terms of senior, in particular, senior level representation in the national security field. Women are at 50% or above in undergrad and grad degrees in my field, and under really, really grueling and horrible circumstances, women are making amazing strides in the armed forces. But people are still being told things like, oh, you know, I hired you as my assistant because you're cute, but you're actually not that cute. That's a real story. And then in doing my research for the panel, I found things like employed women partnered with employed men carry 65% of childcare responsibilities, a figure that has held steady since the turn of the century. So we're not getting anywhere. And part of, I think, getting real is all of us acknowledging to each other that that's a real thing. Life isn't fair, as my parents both taught me. And my final point of an introduction is that this means, and also just the fact of life being finite and us being finite, we do have to make choices. And the way I tend to think about that is that we can do any individual thing we want, but we cannot do every individual thing that we want. And wrestling with the question, both of how to make our choices and how to make peace with our choices, is, I think, one of the really critical foundations of not just being good at what you do, not just being well respected at what you do, but being able to go home at night and say, I feel good about what I did.
Right.
Thank you, Heather.
All right. I'm really happy to be here with all of you. This is a fantastic panel to be on, and I really respect these women who are up here with me. I do something that's completely different in my line of work from what they do, and so I just thought I'd bring my perspective as a songwriter as I was preparing for this. I was thinking about, rather than concentrated on the getting ahead part, you know, getting ahead in whatever business that you're doing. Obviously, politics for me, it's not what I'm going to talk about. although I do talk about it a lot in my lyrics, but I won't talk about that here. No, more about just how you can get ahead in whatever is your chosen profession, you know, what you want to do and as a woman. Now, Sue and I were saying earlier, Sue said, we don't need to talk about just what women need to do to get ahead, but that men need to participate in this too, and that's such a great point. We wanted to have some contention on the panel, but unfortunately it didn't work. We agree. We agree on that. So I just thought about I just sort of wrote down some ideas about what I think are good ideas of how to get ahead. My father, who's here in the audience today, gave me some wonderful advice when I was in school. I was in Fairview, and I would come home, and I was trying on like the slang, and I'd come home and say, "I ain't nobody, nobody know," you know, just trying to use the like slang of the day. And he said to me, "You have two strikes against you. You are a woman, and you are black. You better learn how to speak well." And that has stayed with me all of my life, and has served me well. So I think that's really important to really present yourself as competent, you know? Really, really important. I think hard work is the epitome of anything that you choose to do. If you want to be a writer, you need to be writing. I write every single day. If you are a musician, you need to play the piano or play your instrument every single day. There are no excuses. You're tired. You don't want to do it. You have to, like, put all of the work in, and even more so, in my opinion, if you're a woman, and especially in my business, it's really difficult to find people who are leaders in the independent music, it's opening up, and there it is. There are more possibilities for us to lead the way, but as far as the major studios are concerned, it is a male-dominated marketplace, and it's really, really difficult to navigate that. So the more prepared you are, the more competent you are, the easier it is to navigate those places. What else did I want to talk about? The fact that, I think this is interesting, that a lot of times we think of, there's stereotypes of what are feminine attributes, right? But there is something, and I think that some of the things that we can consider to be feminine attributes and that are proven scientifically are encouraging harmony and agreement in the workplace, where you are with other people's making decisions based on those, on creating harmony as well, and not just from a different place. So I think bringing your femininity also into the workplace is a positive thing that one can do. I think that's good for me. Yeah. I think it's, as I said, communicate superbly. Remember who you are and work hard are that my main points. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Erin Velarde. I'm the founder of Vote Run Lead, and for the fifth time on five panels, we train women to run for office and win. And I'm sorry to whoever has been in all five of my panels. I've started the same way every time. I agree, the communications piece is huge. And the communications discipline is actually what I think you're talking about. And the folks that I have seen be successful, they know how to communicate. They know how to communicate with discipline, and they know when to listen. And they know when to not communicate and how powerful that can be. I think that's one of those skills that many of us can learn to flex. It's not a skill that we're all born with. Some people are natural communicators, but it is definitely a skill that can be taught and can be learned and can be exercised over time. And there can be a comfort level with that as well. I have recently invested in an executive coach, which prior to getting an executive coach, I was like, I don't need an executive coach. Because even when I think at times when outwardly folks are saying to you, oh my God, you're so successful, or your company is doing so well, or I see your nonprofit everywhere. There's always, you're as someone who's leading something and sort of looking for the next thing, you're almost already past that recent press article, right? And you're kind of looking at, okay, how do I leverage that into be this other, this sort of get ahead? And so, you know, here I am telling my executive coach that, listen, everything on the outside's got to look really good, right? While inside we're sort of working on ourselves. And I don't know that I did enough work in my 20s really thinking about what it meant to work on myself. I thought that I could get away with just pure hard work and being the best at what I was doing and, you know, bringing my team along with me. And what that got me was a kidney infection in the hospital for 5 days and, you know, real burnout and real frustration in a job. And so I think that there's a little bit of that self-reflection and that radical self-inquiry about who you want to be and where you want to go and taking that time for yourself. I actually tend to find in the women that I train that women are very unlikely to take private time for themselves, where they are taking a Saturday and they're sitting at a beach and they're not reading a book or not, you know, trying to get better or not scheduling their kids for the week. They're really just reflecting and thinking about what the next thing is that they want to do, or, you know, they want to celebrate themselves, or, you know, what's the next maybe work path they want to take on. But one of the things the executive coach has said to me has been the sort of seasons of life, right? That you can't actually always be in spring. You can't always be fully in bloom all the time. Sometimes you're going to be hot and burnt out, right? Sometimes the leaves are going to fall off and it's going to be winter. But the cycles of that have been really helpful in saying, okay, right now I'm feeling like a little bit like we're in a fall season. You know, things are slowing down. I'm ready to go a little dormant. I want to do some self-care. I want to repair. And it's been a nice frame for me to think about what it means to get ahead that isn't this really linear line of sort of a predetermined what success looks like, right? Which is primarily sort of financial success and public recognition and being an expert and, you know, all of those things. And looking like you have it together on social media. And so I've taken some of that. I've really internalized some of that. And it's been a bit of a struggle, actually. But it's been something that I think as I've been doing it for myself, we've been building it into the work of the organization. Because if we're trying to get women to run for office, we know that they can't be going 90 miles an hour all the time and that there is an element of their lives where they are public facing. And so they have to have that quiet time. They have to have that rejuvenation. They have to have that moment in which they are able to build back their sort of their self-care, their essentially recharge their batteries. And what you're doing when you're recharging your batteries is you're taking stock of what has been successful for you and what has worked for you in the last 6 months, 12 months, a year, and what's not. And what I have found is sort of somewhat consistently around leaders who have been successful, both male and female, is there's an element of nimbleness that if you're pretty good in your core, that if you're, you know, have that the strength, that you're actually able to be nimble as things are coming at you. You're able to be a little more flexible and resilient, make changes as information changes, or maybe you lose a big grant or you don't get the big bid for a company, or, you know, halfway through a song, your lyrics have just stopped coming out of your body, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to take that as, you're going to be more resilient in that. I've also found that leaders who've been able to consistently get ahead have an understanding of the system that they're operating in. So they know the rules of the system that they're operating in. Doesn't mean that they're following them all the time. Doesn't mean that they're not breaking them. But they have an understanding of the system in which they're playing, whether that's business, music, et cetera. And for women, you do find, even in politics, a sort of gendered, what does the gendered system look like? What does that system look like for a black woman? And then the third thing I found in leaders that are sort of consistently getting ahead or starting new things is that they trust themselves. Doesn't mean they don't go through periods of self-doubt, but that generally speaking, they trust that even if they've made a mistake, they're going to figure out how to remedy it. And they can project that trust onto others and then, you know, engage those to build, be a part of their team. They have that kind of loyalty. When you trust yourself too, then somebody can come up to you and be like, oh, that is so wrong, right? Because they know you didn't have that nimbleness that isn't going to, you know, throw you all the way off your path. So those are three things that I've seen for people who have just kind of consistently opened up new chapters of their lives, have defined new definitions of success, and some things that I've learned in just doing some of that for myself in the last few years. So thank you.
Thank you. so many great things.
Hi, I'm Sue, and I have never, ever had trouble being real. It's reported that that started quite early in my life, like 1.5. And really, it's never stopped. This makes a conversation like this interesting for me, and actually putting this inside a women's track is something that's interesting for me also. Because I think in order for women to show up as more real in their leadership, I come at this from a business context, by the way. Since Accelerator might not make sense to anyone in this room, I'm a venture capitalist. So I'm a female venture capitalist. I've made about 70 investments in startup companies, and 40 of those have at least one female in leadership. And just for what it's worth, if you can only invest in companies with a female in leadership, that actually cuts out about 45% of all potential investments. That's kind of earth-shattering to me. Anyway, so I come at this from that context, and then I spend a ton of my time working with companies that are large and small and senior leaders on conscious leadership. And everything about that is creating this aspiration of being your true self, showing up authentically at work. And the reason I find this context so interesting, being in a women in leadership track, and you alluded to it earlier, is that in order for anyone, male or female, to show up authentically at work, there has to be permission to show up authentically at work. And that means that for the men in the room, some of whom are nodding, thank you, you have to create an invitation. And if the invitation is one that you'd like to extend not only to the men that look like you and operate like you and think like you, but to different kinds of people, all kinds of people, people who have kids, people who are grandparents, people of different races, that invitation needs to extend to everyone's form of authenticity. For some people, men and women, that includes emotions, for example. So you, if you'd like to create a company where multiple voices are heard and women can get real and you and men can get real, you have to include in your definition of reality feelings. Because for the most part, a ton of the work I do is just unearthing the feeling that's behind this conflict that's been going on for 2 years. If you've been in conflict in your work for long periods of time, we all know the drill. What we do in those kinds of conflicts that keep going on is we just get more information. If we could just do another study. If we could get more books and stack them up on our side. If I can recruit more people who agree with me and come back into this fight, then I'm definitely going to win. And the truth is, what we miss is the context of how we got to that discussion, how we came to that conflict. And frequently, particularly for women in leadership, that includes emotions. So a huge part of the work I do, and I truly do this as an investor, like I've been in business for 15 years in tech companies, so I can talk about search engine optimizations, I can talk about websites, I can talk about acquisition marketing, I talk about all that stuff. But most of the time, I am not talking about that. Most of the time, I am helping leaders, men and women, but I work with a ton of women, help find what truly motivates them and what they are staying clear of. So if I say to myself, Sue, why did you end up being authentic? Why did you end up being real? Why did you end up being tough your whole life? My nickname when I was a toddler was Susie Too Tough. It's still true, right? Why is that true? Well, it's true because I was radically underparented. I was totally in charge of me and my brother. I took care of everything. I had to. It wasn't really a choice. But now I can't always tell when sort of controlling situations is a choice or when it's just a reflex. So for me, when I'm working with people on how to get real, part of that is just understanding their core motivations and what happened that might have caused them to create behaviors and personalities that help deal with them. Now, that's kind of out there and kind of deep, but maybe it's shallow, whatever. I just want to mention it because I do some executive coaching. I'm not getting a clock yet. I do that. And one of the things I find in coaching and therapy is it's like, hey, you're a leader, you're female, you're underconfident. Well, here's the thing. Just buck up. Get tough. just show up. Like, it's super inspirational, right? And what I do with leaders, including women in that situation, is try to understand, what's the source of this unconfidence? Where did it come from? How can we actually get friendlier with it so that when you see it happening, you can say, hey, unconfidence, cool. You're my imposter voice, it's right here right now. Like, what am I doing up here and you're out there? There's no real reason for that. So it's here. And I can say, yo, hi, in my brain. Hi, imposter voice, that's cool. Can you go just pick up trash on the side of the road outside this room just for the next 40 minutes? And then you can come back and plague me again. It's fine. We just make an agreement. And I just think part of being real is just getting self-aware. And that's most of what I do in the world in everything I do.
Great. Wow. Thank you, Sue. Well, it's time for us to have a conversation among these four amazing women. And I wonder if a place to start with this might be bouncing some of the ideas you heard from each other. I'm sure you've all been inspired in one way or another. Heather, would you want to, or Lisa looks more eager. So, yeah. Okay.
I really want to pick up actually on the last thing that you said, and actually I'm really curious how you deal with this, because at least in my line of work, and I suspect I'm not the only one in the room, there are plenty of times where actually you cannot, in fact, show up with your full self the way you know or suspect yourself to be. And part of the journey, the way I think about it, is choosing your line of work where either you can show up however much you need to show up, or where the choice that there's a part of me that I'm not bringing into this space, and I'm aware of that, and I'm making a conscious choice, and I'm thinking about how to take care of myself, that in and of itself is a conscious and deliberate thing that you're doing.
Or can be.
Yeah. Or can be. I mean, I was just sitting here as you were talking, and I don't think, this is going to sound terrible, it's going to sound like I was ragingly inauthentic for decades, but I don't think I was in any way showing up at work as sort of anything that, if I sat and thought about it, was an authentic me, until through circumstances not entirely of my own, well, no, I chose them, until I left my neat career path to follow my husband to Michigan after I had said, well, I'm not moving to be with you because I have a fancy job in the Clinton administration, but you know, if it works out, I'll move with you next time. And then he was like, yeah, I got my dream job, it's in Detroit. And I was like, ooh, I promised. But until the moment that I got out of the career field and the hierarchy I had picked, I mean, I was totally showing up the way I thought the State Department, the way I thought you could show up at the State Department, the way I thought you could show up at the White House. Like, what were the limits of, in the very misogynist office I worked in, like, what were the limits of me that I could show up and accomplish the things I want to accomplish? And I wonder, I mean, I'm just now looking back at how I got through that, and I wonder, Sue, is that something you see as exclusively a problem of younger women at the beginning of their careers? Is that a choice? How do you think about women who have moved into the leadership phase of their career making those choices?
So you started by saying that I couldn't have shown up this way, Heather. And I think what I would just say is, you know, and yeah, I don't believe you. So not as an absolute matter. Right. So I believe you've been enormously successful. I find myself really inspired by the work you guys are doing because I'd be so inept at it, right? So working in a large political organization where you can rise and do, you know, whatever, I would suck at that. So what I would suggest is, can you see that you made a choice? Right, so my choice is, I'm going to work in a sector where being politic is rewarded, yeah, and consensus is rewarded. I can roll with that. I'm pretty good at it. And I've built a whole career path that's, you know, been fun. And I think I've broken a lot of plates, you know? So there's no right or wrong for either. It's just, I just noticed that there's a choice that you made all the way along, and you're still making.
But I think that just one more little tiny thing, it's also sort of knowing when to stop making that choice.
Right. And I want to add, I think when we talk a lot about sort of our authentic selves, we assume that we have one authentic self.
Yep.
Like, I have
and
seven.
It doesn't change over time.
Right.
Like, I have several personalities. Like, my personality at home when, like, the day is done is, like, I am an introvert, and my husband knows, like, there is no talking for a set period of time. Right. And that I want to play this like stupid word game on my phone for 20 minutes until I need him to help me with one of the words. And then, you know, like, and that's my authentic self after work, right? My authentic self on a panel, I've had to stop cursing on panels because my authentic self from New Jersey is, we curse. Like, it's not a, it's, we're Italian, right? Like,
so are we allowed to curse now on this panel? Because that's great for me.
I want you to know that 2 days
I'm on board with that.
Yeah, I said screw it when I really wanted to say. So, but you know, it's part of the, that piece of like understanding the system you're in, right? And it's the navigation between, you do want to get ahead, you know, you're within that system. So understanding the boundaries, when you know the boundaries, you can either choose to play within them or you can choose to sort of push them or play outside of them. And knowing that who you are at work is not necessarily always who you are at home. You know, sure. There's a reason that we're women who are equal households are then at 65%. At work, you know, doing the burden at home. You might be the boss lady at work, but if you don't have that same relationship at home, that might be your more inauthentic self.
Right? Yeah. That makes so much sense to me. And there's a couple of things that you said that I really, really liked. And one of them was about knowing the rules before you can break them. And I think in so many situations, both in career and at home, you've got to navigate those waters. And if you want to make progress or change things, you cannot do it unless you know exactly what the playing field is. You know, you cannot change them without it. I also really loved the what you were talking about, core motivations for... If you don't know yourself, and these are both related because you were talking about self-care, right? And it's so true that if you don't look out for yourself, if you don't know yourself, how can you possibly advance? Or at least if you do, you might find yourself with a kidney infection if you don't take that time to think about what you need and who you really are. I mean, all of these things are related. I hear them to be related. I don't know.
You know, this last 3 points.
I had an interesting experience this morning. I was talking with one of my students who's about to graduate, and she's looking for jobs. She's looking for an opportunity. And I posed the question to her. I said, well, how would you describe yourself, your skill set, and what you're really good at to someone? Right. Mm-hmm. And she said, I don't know. I said, well, let's talk about what you do well. And that, so slowly we got to a place where she described all these amazing things that she's about. And then I said, let me ask you that question again. Do you know what to say about yourself? And she did. And I was so proud of her because that was a quick study. But I would pose the same kind of question to each of you. Your authentic self is one thing, but how do you think about yourself? What are you good at? And how do you know you're good at it? And if you had to talk to a panel of people who were deciding whether they were going to give you the job or give you this opportunity, what do you say about yourselves? And this is only something a confident person can do.
Mm. That's interesting. For me, can I go ahead?
Yes, you already have one.
For me personally, one of the difficult things about being a musician today is that, I'm an independent musician. I'm not on a major label. So a lot of my time is spent, unfortunately, seeking for funds for the next album, you know? And that means talking about my music and talking about my art and trying to get people to give me money. So that I can make more of it, and I find it difficult. I mean, it's gotten better in the last few years. But you're right; it's really important that we know our strengths and are able to sell ourselves. I don't like the idea of selling myself, but that's in the end. That's sort of what it is, you know. If I want to continue making art, and it took me a long time to get to a place where I could say, okay, it's not bad to speak well of myself. It's not bad to know where my strengths lie as a musician. And I still have a lot of things that I'm not terribly confident about, and I try to gloss over those, you know. But I do feel like that it's important to be as transparent and as honest about how I feel about my work as possible. So even in the weaknesses, I think one of the things that we say in music often is, as a singer, you should try to take your weaknesses and turn them into your strengths. And I think that can apply to any kind of any work. You know?
So what are you really good at, Lisa?
I'm really good at writing lyrics. I'm a great poetess. You know, I'm good with wordplay. I'm very, very confident on stage. So what are my weaknesses?
She didn't ask. Nobody asked.
Okay, I don't have to say it. Thank God. Phew. I feel like I'm just going on and on now, I've got permission, so I can go on and on about how. But I think that my greatest strength is really that the communication that I'm able to develop between an audience and myself on stage. That's where my largest weakness lies. My largest strength. What the hell?
But your weaknesses are your strength.
Oh, there's the hell. I mean, I'm swearing and I'm.
Contagious.
I had the most wonderful experience recently of actually discovering that there was a category for a thing that I'm good at. That over the course of my career, I've been a really good writer. I've been a really good Russia expert. I've been a really good manager of a small nonprofit. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I've had this uncomfortable feeling that what I was really good at was synthesizing connections between ideas and between people. Mm-hmm. And like, what the hell is that? And then I read a book about network theory, and which had a whole section on how there's such a thing as network tenders who can step back and look at the whole of a network and see where there aren't links that should be made or where there are links that should be strengthened. And the author of the book, who happens to be my boss, actually, embarrassingly, I hadn't read her book earlier. I just confessed that on tape. Ouch. Not a good idea. We'll edit that out. says, and network tender is a real role which needs to be recognized and compensated. And I was on an airplane, and I went, yes, that's what I do. And it was so exciting, which, so you aren't going to, it's not going to be the same thing your whole life, as Aaron said. And something else that I'm really curious what you would say about, given your what you do for a living, this idea that, you know, even if we're not quite brave enough to be an independent musician, the way the world works, we now are all selling our brand all the time. Or not all the time, but maybe at least some of the time. And that we do have to think about.
Do you find that difficult?
Oh, hell yeah. I'm much more interested in selling ideas and causes and other, like, you know, I want to go around and talk about your music, right? That's easy for me.
Oh, God.
Talking about my writing is much harder for me.
Mm-hmm. I'm really, really fast. And I'm really good at spotting a nucleus of talent, especially in younger people. And cultivating that over decades. And I've come to think of myself, I've come to categorize this quality that I have as hard as I'm going to admit this for the first time. I'm magnetic. I'm passionate and real and playful, and I move through the world quickly. And when I look behind me, there are usually other people there going with me.
And I want to be Sue when I grow up.
We all do, I think. That's my fantasy, too.
Yeah, I found I have a similar skill set in spotting talent. And I think what I'm really good at is almost sneakily having women, particularly women, shed the barriers that they've put up for themselves without them knowing that they're shedding the barriers. And that kind of personal self-permission, like I'm not giving them permission. I'm showing them a path in which they can give themselves permission. And I got to be a mentee under a woman who knew how to do that very well. So I got to learn sort of almost by osmosis and just watching her do that for people. And selfishly, it's extremely rewarding. I mean, there's nothing that feels better than sort of watching other people thrive. I think I can take a series of pieces of information, and I can quickly set a vision for how those challenges or how those ideas can all come together in a coherent pathway in which we can get to point X. And that, I think, is very motivating for other people to sign on to an idea. And I'm really good at like calling out bullshit. Right? Like it's this, I physically, I'm good at that, right? People, like my face is not one of those faces where I can sit in a meeting and you know exactly what I'm thinking. And what I've learned to channel that in a way that I can then communicate with someone that like the same thing, like I didn't believe her either, you know? And to be able to call that on people is something that I would love for more of us to do. I often feel like I have to play that role because we're sitting in a meeting and the smartest person in the room is talking and everyone's saying what a good idea that is when all of us know that's really not a good idea, right? And so there's I'm almost naturally too honest. I'm a good little white liar, don't get me wrong, but I can never tell a big lie. I cannot sit in the space of a big lie or something that feels, you know, that it isn't sort of, yeah, rooted in the truth. And I find that sometimes particularly in groups of women, we are too agreeable in that we're allowing something that we are not necessarily that comfortable with to occur because we see that the group is comfortable. And so that's something that, even as a young person, I've not been able to sit in that room and say, no. I'm not sure what the no is exactly. Maybe I couldn't articulate it always as a younger person, but to
think you might like, but you're not sure, or try the thing that everybody else thinks you should like and then prove to yourself that you hate it and move on.
My suggestion is ask 10 people that are friends and family about how risk preferring you are. Mm. Because some people up here are very risk preferring and some people may not be. So I would, this whole thing about like following your heart, follow your passion, depends on how much you like ramen. If you love ramen and you don't mind tents and sleeping in them in the rain, then it's much easier to do exactly what you're most passionate about. If you actually prefer a roof and you occasionally like to eat protein, then you may want to take smaller steps. Like find the thing that lights you up and go get a job that's less than you might think you're worth, but go get a job for $25,000 and do an internship with a cause that you care about. You might just take a stutter step to jumping off the cliff.
Yeah, great. Well, here's the question that came in first, and I think it's for you, Heather. What's the book about network theory?
It's Anne-Marie Slaughter's book on network theory. And what's really great is, and I'm sorry, I don't know the title, but if you Google Anne-Marie Slaughter network theory, you'll find it. And it's basically like, I studied up on network theory so you don't have to. So it's very, I mean, network theory is an amazingly complex thing that I don't know nearly enough about, but it's really sort of easily or somewhat easily digestible for the rest of us.
Okay, here's a question for all of you. What pushes you to get past the hardships in your careers in order to get ahead?
So, okay, I'll tell. I'm 5 months pregnant, and my husband does not want my mother in the delivery room with us. He wants that to be like our thing. So I'm like, okay, that's great. I'm fine with that. But she's always been the person that, you know, I'm like, yeah, wait until I'm like, go get my mother. And then she'll be in there. Because she's always been the person who goes, okay, get over it. You've done wallowing. It's time to go. It's time to do the thing. And what it's taught me is to sort of have that period where, okay, I get the moment to wallow. I get, you know, enough time to kind of say, oh, that really bummed me out or that sucked. But that there has to be a moment for that to stop. Right? There's sort of be the moment where that wraps up and you've done it and you've given yourself the space to do it. But it's time to go, pick up, let's go. And I actually can hear her voice in my head now. I don't even need to call her. You know, it's sort of like this tape that plays. And it's just, you know, it's giving yourself a little bit of space, but you can't sit there forever and think, oh, this is the thing that's like ruined my career. Because that snowball effect is actually really unhealthy. And it is a snowball effect. Because what will happen is if you stay in that bad space, you'll then think that you're a bad person and that nothing good will happen to you, and the snowball gets bigger and bigger. So you've got to put sort of a finite on when things don't go your way and end it.
I cry a lot. I mean, I just cry all the time. There are some times for a couple days. So that's one thing I do. After I'm done crying, because I do eventually stop like now, after you're done with that, here's one thing I do. I ask myself, how did I create exactly this situation? Usually when even the description, hardships in my career, there's a way in which you can enter sort of a victim state or a villain state. That guy's such a jerk, or I can't believe he did that to me. And so frequently what I'll say is, how did I create exactly this outcome? Oh, right. my boss cares a lot about marketing data, and I don't care about it at all, so I've been faking it for a year. And he finally noticed, or she finally noticed. Once I understand how I created that situation, it often helps me figure out what's next for me, because usually if hardship happens, I've usually lit the fuse on the bomb, and I've placed the bomb there, and there's a reason for it. And it was that something was out of alignment and a change needed to happen, and I get an understanding about which change would be of service.
That's so interesting. That's very similar to both of your answers are things that I do as well. I think hardships in music are constant. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you have to have such a thick skin and really be driven to make any progress as a musician. And that's a personal struggle with your instrument, which for me is piano and voice. And you know, the constant comparison to the people that you admire. And the constant striving to arrive there, and you just feeling like you can't get up that mountain. So it's really important introspection, and also the fact that you light the fuse. I love that, because that's exactly what I look at. When something doesn't go my way, I say, what have I done, what do I continue to do that this will not go my way? So yeah, both of your answers encapsulate exactly how I feel.
Now, I am a person that I have to be careful not to get too far into the loop of I caused this or I will never get myself out of it.
Oh, no.
And so I feel like there is a fancy way that you can talk about this, which is sort of going back to your core purpose. And then there is a non-fancy way, which is sort of I'm just incredibly goddamn stubborn. when I was in high school, I apologize if anyone's heard me tell this story in another panel. I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to be a ballet dancer. And at one point, the head of the ballet school called my parents in, and they said that you understand that your daughter's not very talented, right? And then he said, but we've never seen a child get this far on sheer determination. And so I did eventually make it into their company. And then the company went out of business. And that unpleasant experience allowed me to decide on my own that I had kind of checked that box and I could now like proceed to do the thing my parents were really hoping I would do, which was graduate high school and go on to college. And I can't claim that I did that through any like great process of introspection, although I can see how, I mean, I don't disagree with anything you said, but some of us, I'm greatly in favor of just blind determination as a life tool and a life force.
So this next question is about looking into the future. Discuss what the future would be like where work sharing is the norm.
Work sharing is really cool. I love the thought of that for singing. It'd be awesome.
Duets.
You know, my work is on political leadership. It's getting women to run for office. One of the things I wanted to share in what the panel title is the curriculum that we've built after the surge of women running for office. So I've been doing, prior to the 2016 election, we had about 12 years worth of curriculum on gendered leadership development, intersectional feminism, what was it about political systems that were holding women back. And then 10,000 women raised their hand to run for office. And it turned out that they were actually not that politically savvy, right? Although they were voters, they, you know, were interested in the candidates that they had voted for, had a cause or, you know, one core issue, there was really low civic literacy. So didn't know what these particular offices did, and definitely didn't understand how sort of singular a candidacy is, that they're both the candidate and they're on this team of people who are, they're relying on other people to vote for them. So it's not like you're going for a job when really one or two people in an interview process are deciding whether you're going to win. You're trying to get hundreds, maybe a few thousand, potentially millions if you're running for very high office, to vote for you. And so you're the sort of front person on the top of a mountain. And the entire work of campaigning and to being a really effective elected official is actually that you're sharing the work. There's no way that you're going to know every single policy issue that is going to come across your desk. You need other people who have that expertise. You need folks that are going to potentially write bills for you. There are bill writers who write legislation and hand it over to the state legislatures. They're not, you know, they're not actually going home and writing and crafting policy. And so we had to change the way that we were teaching how to be a really good candidate and how to be an effective elected official. And only one of the six components of the curriculum, which is now called Run As You Are, is how to run for office. The other is, you know, around qualifications and confidence and knowing the things that you're good at and the things that you're not so good at. One of the other pieces is brand and reputation. What do you want to be known for when you run for public office? But the two that I am very pleased that we've integrated into the curriculum are people and networks. That you actually cannot be a successful elected official. That sort of singular person, that highest person on the top of the mountain, without effectively leveraging people and networks, you cannot get it done. They won't vote for you. They won't donate to you. It is a core of people that you are moving around. And the other is practice and feedback. You have to be engaging with people in order to hear the ideas of constituents, in order for you to understand how you represent them. Running for office and being an elected official is the ultimate work share because you're representing 15,000 people in a district. You have 15,000 bosses. You have 15,000 colleagues that want to give you their opinion via email and Twitter and many of the other ways that you have a team underneath you that does community constituents. You have to work with other legislators to actually get things done and get that passed or even that bill out to committee. And it's been a fascinating thing to watch as women who were once really fearful of being the sort of singular person out there and asking folks for their vote to realize that they're just essentially the front man in a group of people who are trying to move an agenda forward. And it has been one of those things that's actually allowed women to be more comfortable in stepping out to the candidacy to say, you have the right ideas to lead, but you've got to bring all these people along with you, and all these people are going to help you be successful if you work in harmony with them. So it's a little bit of a tangential answer, but I hope that fits.
Yeah, great. Really helpful. Anyone else on that question?
We had, in my field, a little, I mean, nobody job shares in foreign policy and national security, but we had a really interesting moment when the period in the Obama administration when the Secretary of State was a woman and the number three person at the Defense Department for the first time in the history of the Defense Department was a woman. And for the first time in the history of both of those institutions, there was a really changed view on what you could do around maternity leave and what you could do around coming back from maternity leave and what you could do around part-time employment, which is generally regarded as just such a ridiculous thing that you should be ridiculed for even suggesting that you could work part-time or job share or have flexible hours in that field. And what's really worth noting is both the incredible loyalty that both the Secretary of State and the Undersecretary of Defense had from their staffs, and the way that those staffs and the way they worked experienced themselves being in conflict with the National Security Council, which, to put it mildly, didn't operate that way, especially in the first term. And that there was this real kind of clash of styles. And this leads me to actually a prediction I would make more broadly, that we in American culture and across the American workplace, we really have, and this goes very directly to what Aaron just said, we really have this myth of how it's like the individual, the great man, does everything. And whether it's, you know, whether it's Steve Jobs, I mean, who didn't really do everything, or just like the person in your office who made something happen, we constantly... we overlook the contributions of teams. And I think it will be interesting to see both whether job sharing chips away at that and or whether we have to chip away at that first in order to have job sharing.
So here's a question directed just to you, Lisa Marie. What's your best advice for being a full-time artist? I'm pursuing that more and more every day and admire you so much for what you do.
I appreciate that, and thank you very much. I think it's what I said in the beginning of this panel in my introductory statement was just the idea that you have to work at it every day, that you have to own your art, that you have to dig deep, be as transparent, as honest as possible as you're doing it, and commit yourself to it. And there, a lot of musicians, people get into music and say, "Oh, I want to make money." And you can't if you decide to be an artist, you can't be thinking about what that is going to lead to. You just have to make the art. You just have to get out and do it and be committed to it 100%. I can't think of anything else. I was thinking about job sharing. You made me laugh when you said, I wonder what that looks like in music. But that's all it is if you have a band.
Right. Great. So here's a question for all of you or any of you. Do you think we could be where we are now with women's rights, which is still a work in progress, without the Me Too movement and without our president being someone with sexual assault allegations against him?
So I think that question is, I think the way I interpret that is, are these things, well, yes, right. So we're equating the Me Too movement and the non-Me Too movement of Trump. So I think that some of the time lately, I've been thinking that a lot of what's going on around topics related to women feels really 1979 to me. And it's been really bumming me out a lot. I feel at sea about it. When I started this fund that focused on companies with a female in leadership, I thought, gosh, maybe I'll just get asked to speak around issues about women. And this is, you know, what we talked about earlier today. Right. I'm like, there's so much else. I mean, I love to talk about golf. Could we talk about golf maybe? And those are three non sequiturs. The answer is, I think we are going to look back at this administration as the best thing that's ever, ever happened to women's equality.
Wow.
Yeah. Boy, from your lips to God's ears.
Yeah.
One of the emotions that I'm finding, and you said this word earlier, you know, everybody keeps talking about go with your passion, yet you can't be emotional. I find that radical and odd. One of the emotions that we are allowing women to have in a way that I don't know that I wasn't around in 1979, but I don't know if it was as common as it is right now, is that we are totally okay with seeing angry women. And this, we are all really angry. I think, you know, people ask me, oh, did you cry after the election? I was like, of course I did. But those were angry tears. Yeah. Like, that was like anger coming out of my face because I didn't know how to express it otherwise. I wasn't like, I was just, water was coming out because it was like anger leaving my body. And I am, it's so wonderful to see angry women and then to see those angry women channel that into really constructive action. And I'm not sure that we had that room for that. I'm not sure that we had that we were all kind of okay with seeing that the way we are after the 2016 election. So that's one of the ways that I think, and I think the Me Too movement is a direct result of feeling that there was no consequence and the anger about having no pathway for justice and having somebody that has had those allegations in fact be rewarded. And the downfall that we're seeing of men's careers is just the beginning of what I think will be powerful public policy when we get around to getting to that phase and really figuring out what that looks like. That allows you to be angry when somebody harasses you or allows you to be angry when somebody touches you in a way that you don't have to freeze in the moment. You can actually react with some level of sort of both vocal and physical reaction that is then allowed, that you're not the crazy woman who overreacted, that nope, everybody knows that that's sexual harassment. So I think we'll get there.
I really disagree. I regretfully disagree with the idea that we're okay with women's anger in this moment. I don't experience that in my professional life. Mm-hmm. And I experience that women in my field are still dealing with an enormous amount of fear around sort of calling out past experiences, and also fear about trying to make changes going forward, and resistance, and frankly a sense of, which I think there was a lot of around the Clinton presidential campaign too, sort of totally apart from everything else, but this zero-sumness of the world and this feeling that every advance for women is at the expense of right. men. And I feel that very palpably day-to-day in my field. So I don't so much want to argue with you as I just want to report my own experience that my colleagues and I have a lot of anger and have a lot of observations around. I mean, I delete at least two invitations to Mantle's a week. A Mantle is an all-male panel. At least two a week. It's like nothing, and I debate Should I write to this funder? Will that mean I never get a grant from this funder again? Mm-hmm. Can I write to the funder without being angry? So...
Well, I regret that we are out of time for this panel, but this was a panel where everyone got very real about life and politics and work. And please thank the panelists for their insights. This was great.